hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts, Jacob Cazell, Jeff Chaney, and Todd Singer.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the No Better Than Average podcast. I am your co-host, Jacob, and with me are my other co-hosts, Todd and Jeff. Jeff, how are you doing this fine day?
I am doing well. I just got back from taking my middle son out to practice driving.
Oh, no. Is everybody still alive?
Everyone's still alive. As a treat for still being alive, we went to Dairy Queen afterwards.
Awesome.
Sweet. Cool.
So yeah, my baby boy is driving. So yeah, fun stuff.
I just think in like less than a year, you'll have to buy another car.
Yay.
All right. So are you going to buy the new car and then give him yours as a hand-me-down?
No, my car's too new.
Be like $3,000 a month insurance.
Yeah. Well, it's not as bad as when you had that sports car.
Well, yeah.
Pro tip, don't have a sports car and a teenager.
Yeah.
Todd, how are you doing?
I'm recovering from Labor Day work outdoors.
Oh.
We did all the... I'm just the unhired or the unskilled labor, you know. Go get that plant, dig it up, move it over here. Okay, go get that bag of mulch, put it over there. I did that kind of stuff. And, you know, my muscles are a little sore, but they're getting there. They're getting back to normal.
You know, I think Labor Day is supposed to be a celebration of labor in the workforce and not a day of actually going out and laboring.
Well, you know, I've made up for it today by logging into work and working on the budget because that's our busy time right now. Yay!
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun. I went hiking 2 days this weekend and drug the family all up and down hills, but had a good time and then managed to land a wallop of like a sinus cold. So yay me. I'm sure I sound just great to all of our listeners out there at home. And hey, listeners, while I've got you, how about this segue? If you have a question, a comment, a rant, please give us a call on our call-in comment line. That number is, as always, 317-643-1212. You will talk to a robot, a machine, the way God intended. You won't have to talk to a human, so you won't have to be caught off guard. You can just leave your rant, and we will listen to it and maybe laugh at you a little bit, and then we will put it on air and make the internet famous. You can also subscribe to our newsletter. We might get around to sending another one of those out one of these days, and you can do that at nobettershow.com/join. And as always, if you want to support the show, we would really appreciate that, and you can do that at patreon.com/nobettershow. This show, we actually have a guest, so we are going to be playing that interview momentarily. A gentleman by the name of Eric Cazzo from Entangled Media, and they make an app called Unity, which is kind of a cool little app. It's basically a client that you run on your desktop, and they have clients for Windows and for Mac, and then an app that you run on a mobile device, and they have iOS and Android, and it gives you your own personal cloud. Which it works really well. I've played with it and I've been using it for a couple of weeks now. And sure enough, you can get access to all of your files. And so you may have heard the term out there in the wild called the zero knowledge cloud. And basically, what it is cloud services where the provider has no knowledge of the content that is stored with them. You know, so like where you encrypt all of your data and then put it somewhere and they have no way of getting to your data. So unlike somebody like Dropbox who can and does comply with national security letters, you know, a zero knowledge cloud service is one where they don't have the keys to your data, even if they wanted to. They can hand over the encrypted data and then you just have to hope that the government can't break it, even though we all know they probably can, and they're listening to us right now, and oh God, what are we doing? But anyway, so what they've done is kind of cut the cloud out, and you are your own cloud service. And they also have the capability of doing media streaming sort of a home media server and all of that fun stuff. And anyway, we'll get into that interview. It's really interesting. So definitely go check out the app. It's free to kick the tires, and they do have a paid tier if you become a power user, and you can check it out at getunity.com, and that is getyounity.com. But before we get into that, we had some breaking news this week, and I want to jump to Todd as our resident Android expert. The Samsung's latest flagship has been nearly globally recalled. The Note 7 apparently is bursting into flames and burning people and killing and maiming. And what does this mean for us, Todd?
Yeah, so to back up to last week where you were concerned about the speed of the Note 7 compared to like the Apple and the Nexus 6P. Good news, Samsung doesn't have to worry about that anymore. Now they just have to worry about exploding batteries in the Note 7. It's affected so far about 35 devices out of a million sold. And they've recalled it everywhere except for China, because in China they used a different battery supplier.
Oh, it's not like a form of population control?
Not that we know of. Some people think that the Russians hacked into Samsung's supply chain and now are causing the batteries to explode.
Those pesky Russians.
But that's all rumor. They've recalled it. There's several different ways, depending on your carrier, how you can go in and return it. But the letter that Samsung sent out said that while if you send your phone in to get replaced, like if you order direct from Samsung, they'll give you an S7 or S7 Edge in exchange and refund the difference if you didn't want to wait for another Note 7. And they also would give you a $25 phone bill credit or a $25 gift card for the inconvenience. I mean, a whole $25. But I will say I have to give them some kudos for reacting quickly once it did get to be documented. It is a safety issue, obviously, so you would want them to recall all the devices because, you know, fire could start, etc. If you want to be cynical, it's, well, yes, a fire could start, so they were worried about getting sued.
Right.
So, however you want to look at it, they did recall nearly everything on their premium device of 2016.
So I know that you always hear those things like I'm sure it's an urban legend, but you've heard that car companies don't issue a recall until they've crunched the math and the cost of getting sued and having to pay out is greater than the cost of the recall and all of that fun stuff. So pointing out 35. Confirmed cases out of a million units shipped is 0.035%. So that's a very, very small number.
And interesting, some of the articles that I read implied that it was only the devices that only exploded on people using non-Samsung USB-C connections.
Ah. Really?
So I don't know if that's true or not, but if that's really true, it's like, they may be going a little overboard.
It is their first device to use USB-C,
right.
And there are plenty of USB-C cables that are really not up to snuff and that are a little riskier than
right.
some of the premium brands. So I could see that being an issue, but as a company that's selling them, probably they figure it's probably too risky for something bad to happen.
Right.
So they're just
won't somebody think of the children?
Them. Yeah, yeah. And, they did fix a thing from the 2015 where you can't put the stylus in backwards. So they got that fixed.
Yeah.
Just the exploding battery thing they'll have to work on for next time.
Yeah.
We focused on the stylus. We forgot about the battery safety. So, I mean, just speculating for a minute, what does that really mean? I mean, the Note 7 has been out for, just a few weeks now? And it's, obviously Samsung's big flagship phone releasing, maybe a month ahead of the iPhone 7. And we're all geared up for a big Apple announcement this coming week, the week of Labor Day, and on which Apple is expected to unveil, all of the new sexiness that's coming out. And so this has got to be a huge, huge setback for Samsung. Are they going to be able to recover and reship and restock and be ready for the holiday season, which I know that's a critical thing for all of the carriers this time of year? And what does it do for people who are like, well, I was kind of on the fence, but I'm screw that. I'm going to go and get something besides a Samsung.
Well, this isn't their flagship device, for one, and it's going to be a dent in their mobile earnings, I'm sure, for the quarter, but Samsung's a big company. They've got plenty of other divisions to, I don't want to say paper over, but to absorb the loss in the short term. They'll be fine, and they'll start, you know, I'm sure they're working on the S8, and we'll be releasing that in the first quarter, and if it's as successful as the S7, then this will just be it's more than a blip, I suppose, but it'll be a bad quarter that they get over pretty quickly.
It's not going to hurt Samsung itself as a corporation in the long run, but does it potentially set them up to be unseated as the, you know, biggest Android phone manufacturer out there? Does it open the opportunity for Huawei or some of these other, you know, companies that are nipping at their heels to overtake them, or is the gap just too big between Samsung and, you know, number two and number three?
Well, I suppose it's possible, but the number two and number three are China-based, right? And if they're not recalling if they're not recalling the Note 7 in China, you would think it would have not as much of an impact in that market for their other competitors to capitalize on.
Well,
so
that's
true. I don't think that they'll close much of a gap, maybe a little bit, but again, it's not like it's the S7.
Maybe that's why they're not doing the recall in China.
There you
go. Conspiracy theories. They can't afford to give it up the market.
Could it really bump up Apple's, you know, 7 Plus sales, though? Because, again, it isn't their flagship phone, but it's their I want a big phone.
Right.
That could help Apple, especially in the U.S. market.
I would think the type, this is just speculation, but the type of people that buy the Note 7 are probably not going to switch to Apple. Not very many of them. Because Note 7 owners are your Android enthusiasts in general.
So what are they going to do? Just wait for the next Note and hope that its battery doesn't explode too, or
they're going to get a replacement.
Yeah.
If they wanted the Note 7, then most, not all, but most will just get a replacement Note 7. Now, for somebody who said, you know, hey, I want to try something different, and they were like switching over to Android from Apple, or they wanted to, you know, get a Note 7 as a premium device, though, they may be gone. They may say, you know what, never mind. This is too much trouble, and I'll go ahead and buy the Apple instead. But I would think that that's a lower percentage.
It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, the hardcore users and whatnot, but I was just at a family gathering for a birthday party today, in fact, and my sister-in-law just got, a few days ago, a Note 7, and, you know, was looking at it, and it's affected by the recall, and I guess she's already been notified and doesn't quite know yet what that process is going to look like, or at least she didn't seem to remember the details from the letter that she got, and, you know, she's not a technical person. She's, I mean, kind of the opposite of that. Like, she's just running it stock. She's never going to customize it. It's, you know, I don't know why she picked that one, because she said she even considered the iPhone. So I don't know what she's going to do. And a large chunk of the family is all on iOS. And so it may cause her to swing the other way. With that being said, I had a chance to play with the Note 7. And I will say that OLED screen that they've got in there is gorgeous. So
I like the OLED.
It was sexy. I love OLED indoors, but outdoors, I'm not a huge fan of OLED.
Do you know which carrier she's with?
Almost positive it's AT&T, although I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, yeah, they're still up in the air, but supposedly they're working with Samsung to facilitate exchanges at the AT&T stores.
Yeah, and I don't, like I said, she's not a technical person. She said, I got a letter, I got to do something, I don't really know. And I mean, I think there are a lot more of those people out there than you think, that, you know, she wanted a bigger phone, and, you know, that was, she had other Samsungs, and that was the one that she picked. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens as this story unfolds.
Yeah, I may be paying too much attention to the vocal minority that are such Samsung fanboys that, you know, they're not switching to Apple.
Right. And it'll be curious. I mean, we'll definitely have to keep our eye on it, and maybe check back in as we know more and all of that fun stuff, but I definitely wanted to touch on it since I knew it was a kind of a hot breaking topic and didn't want it to get overshadowed with all of the Apple news that I'm sure Jeff and I will be gleefully talking about on our next episode, and that you will probably just kind of sit there and go harumph to.
We'll see. I'll ask questions.
You're going to have to dig and find some really juicy average Android stuff for the next show, Todd. It's going to be hard to overshadow how excited we are. I mean, I think we know almost everything about the new iPhone, but we're still going to obsess over it like the fanboys that we are.
I'll just have a couple quick items and let you guys go to it.
Sounds good.
Yep.
All right. So as I said, we've got Eric Cazzo from Entangled Media. So we are going to jump into that interview, and then we will be back at the end to talk about what we love and let you guys get back to your day and your week. So here is Eric Cazzo. So, Eric, tell me a little bit about your background. From looking online, you have done a lot at a lot of places. Kind of what brought you to where you are, where you co-founded Entangled Media, and sort of what has set the stage to bring you kind of where you are today?
Sure. Well, one way or another, for the last, 15 to 18 years, I've just worked on products. Out of college, I started in aerospace and defense. Kind of found that to be really exciting work, realized those companies are incredibly challenging to work within. And I naturally gravitated towards internet at that point. And since then, I've just been building products around internet technology of one way, shape, or form since then. So I've just always kind of been involved in creating new products to solve interesting problems and taking those products to market. And that kind of naturally led to starting out at existing companies, but then getting to the point to where you wanted to go and take a product to market that you conceived and try to make an entirely new market in some cases.
Now, have you always been a digital products person, or do you have experience with physical products as well?
Well, the very early days when I was in aerospace, we made imaging systems.
Okay.
So, I worked with physical products, at that point in time. But more or less, it's always been software, not too much hardware, or anything like that.
Okay, sure. So you are currently co-founder and CEO of Entangled Media, and your sort of keystone product is an app called Unity. And
that's right.
And so I downloaded Unity a couple of weeks ago when I first started the back and forth communications of setting up this interview, and have been using it off and on for a couple of weeks. And I have to say it's pretty darn simple. Like, I was expecting hoops to be jumped through, and I installed the client on my desktop, and I installed the mobile app on my mobile, and bam, everything was right there. So maybe talk just a little bit about what Unity is and what your vision is for bringing these, basically the personal cloud to people who have no knowledge of setting up technology. You know, like, I feel like I could give it to my parents, and with very minimal instructions, they could be using it, and they are not technical people at all.
Well, that's good to hear. That was obviously the goal. Technology can often be pretty challenging, can have a lot of requirements that you have to jump through. So we really wanted to avoid that. Unity was essentially created out of necessity. Probably like most people, I had the problem where I had lots of content spread across different computers. My desktop computer at home, my laptop for work, my wife's laptop. We have photos and videos and music kind of scattered about, and it's just challenging to get files and media when they're on different devices. So in its most simple form, Unity lets you access the files and media you have across all the different computers that you have from your smartphone or your tablet. You install it on your computer. In fact, you can install it on all the computers that you have and then put it on a mobile device. And one of the cool, unique things that Unity does is it actually takes all of the media libraries you have. So for example, my wife's iTunes account, everything she buys on her computer and mine on my computers, and merges all of that content into one single UI, into one app that lets you browse all of your files. So it's kind of like a unified media manager. It'll discover everything you have on your computer. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to tell it where the files are, what files you care about. But it'll find all the media and the files that you have across those devices. It'll unify them into the mobile app, and then you can browse or search for the content you want, and you can access it on demand no matter where you are. So you're traveling maybe in some awesome place like Hawaii, and all of your computers are back in the mainland, you always have access to every photo that you've ever taken, all the movies and home videos you have, and all the music and playlists that you created across, all the iTunes accounts or libraries that you have. So it's really just about having all of your content with you all the time. There's no syncing, there's no uploading to cloud storage. Instead of requiring you to put it someplace, typically that could be insecure and often very expensive, we simply turn your computers into the cloud. So that's kind of the concept of the personal cloud, is that instead of us taking all of your files and putting them on our hardware in a data center that we manage, we simply turn your computers into the data center. The software simply enables them to talk to one another and then stream the content back and forth between the devices.
So, you know, how does something like Unity really differentiate itself from, you know, the other cloud-based storage solutions? I mean, I kind of know the answer to this, but I want to hear your position and take on it from, you know, like a Box.com or a Dropbox. You know, why would someone choose to use Unity as opposed to use one of those type of services?
Right. So there's two really big differences. The first one's pretty obvious, and that is we don't store any user content online. We don't even have storage servers. So there's really nothing at all stored online. And in our case, the only things we have are usernames and you know, the encrypted password hashes for each user account. So we don't have any content or know about anything that our users have. And online storage services obviously take all the content that you upload and keep them on a variety of storage servers with everyone else's content. So that's one obvious difference. But you know, the second one is probably the most important, and it's really subtle that most people don't necessarily recognize right away, and that is online storage is a great service. Personally, I use a variety of online storage services, and I would say Unity doesn't really affect my usage of those at all. They're great for files and folders, right? But they were never designed for media, right? Mm-hmm. When I want to go listen to music, I don't go navigate to a file within a folder and click it like it's a Word document or a PDF. I want to browse my media, my music, by maybe artist or a playlist or things like that. And online storage doesn't know what a media library is. It doesn't know what an iTunes catalog is.
Right.
It doesn't understand sort of this curation that we have. And the reality is that over 90% of the content people have is media. It's music, photos, and video. And we have so much of it, we have to organize it and curate it in these apps like Apple Photos or Adobe Lightroom for our photos or iTunes for our music. And when you take those libraries and put them in online storage, it simply eliminates the ability to browse the content the way you organized it. What Unity does is it figures out, it understands all of the organization you've created. So when I connect my iTunes account on a computer to Unity, I turn my computer into a service like Spotify. If I connect it to all the movies that I have on another computer, I turn my computer into a service like Netflix. So it's taking this concept of what these online services give us, like maybe a Spotify or Netflix, which are fantastic, and it brings that to our own content. And when you consider the fact that most people have been collecting content or creating it for most of their adult lives at this point. You know, we have a lot of content that's our own. That is maybe our favorite collections of music, our favorite movies, or home videos that we care a whole lot about. And that can be distinctly different from things that we're discovering using other services like Spotify or Netflix or things like that. So, you know, there's this difference, I think, in a lot of people's minds of discovered content, things that are mine that I've collected and curated over the years, versus the things that I'm discovering on a new basis where I use something like Spotify or maybe Netflix.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, one of the things that that I'm curious about is as some of the, you know, cord cutting services and streaming services grow. Like I know myself, I adopted using Apple Music when it launched, I think it was last July. And, you know, since then I've stopped acquiring music myself. And, you know, I'm guilty of, you know, kind of trusting that that's always going to be there and that I'm always going to be willing to pay, you know, $15 a month. And, you know, so I've really stopped growing my music collection. And, you know, is that a concern? Do you see people moving in that direction or do you still see people maintaining pretty sizable media collections, you know, of movies and music and things like that still for, you know, non-user created content? Like I love it for, you know, like a perfect example. I was able to show coworkers a couple of weeks ago a little video that I had whipped together in iPhoto from a family vacation. And obviously that's not something that's on a Netflix. That's something that was, you know, I created and it worked great. And they all went, oh, wow, that's a really slick app. But, you know, how do you see that that divergence of media we own versus basically perpetual rent possibly affecting the future? And I don't know, Jeff, I think you're kind of probably in the same boat. Do you still own media?
You know, I have like 23,000 songs, but I haven't bought a single song since Apple Music. You know, I could see it being useful for photos, but there again, like I don't, you know, all my photos are uploaded to Google. And, you know, if I want to show people photos I just pull up my Google Photos account. Where it could be valuable to me, I own a bajillion DVDs. I know you know that, Jacob. Now, I have not ripped those DVDs. So, you know, if I went about doing that, I could see that being extremely useful for me because I don't want to rebuy all of those DVDs and Blu-rays that I own and have to rebuy them digitally. So I could see that being extremely useful for me, but I just haven't gotten around to doing that, you know, ripping stuff to be able to stream it. But I that to me would be the big you know, plus for me. You know, Apple Music, I pay for Apple Match too, so all my songs are available to me. So I mean, I won't use this for music just because for me, I'm already, you know, I have the family account of Apple Music. I have the Music Match, so I get all the songs that aren't on Apple Music, which I have, I don't know, probably 5,000 Disney tracks from the parks and all that kind of stuff. So obviously that's not on Apple Music, but I get it because I do the match. But video, I think, would be extremely useful. Documents as well, just again, not because I don't own those other services. I do, but you know, sometimes you just don't take the time to remember that, and having this app up and running is useful to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think individual use cases vary.
Sure.
People will never stop having content.
Right.
Right. You know, whether what you care about more is music, video, photos, or documents, people create content daily, continuously. And there's absolutely no slowing down of that trend. So when we look at analytics of what a typical user looks like, typical user has over 20,000 photos per computer.
Sure.
And the average household has many computers in it. The amount of video that people are creating, creating or collecting is increasing every single month, as is the amount of music that people have every single month. So, you know, what we know is that on average, people are increasing the amount of music, photos, video, and documents they have every single month, and that has never slowed down. And in fact, especially in video's case, it accelerated so rapidly in the last couple of years, it's kind of been shocking to us, even though we expect these trends. So, you know, I think people have different tendencies to use different products. When Spotify came to the US and announced premium, I didn't even try it, I just paid for it, right? In my case, I use Spotify when I discover great music, I go listen to the band. If I like the band, I go buy it,
right?
Right? That's what we all do. Some people do that, some people don't. Spotify has tens of millions of users and I think something like, I don't know, 30 million paying subscribers, right? And the paying subscribers are really the only people in Apple Music or in Spotify that get access to the things they want.
Right.
So that's quite a few, right? I mean, I think, you know, Spotify and Apple together are maybe something like 50 million people who have access to, you know, whatever those streaming services have. There's something like 1.1 billion iTunes accounts. So when you look at the amount of people that are on iTunes or on other services, whether they're buying music in a lot of these countries, right? And this may blow everyone's mind, right? But if you go to a country like England or Japan, the vast majority of music consumed there is a physical CD that they buy in a store.
Really?
Right? So look at music sales. You know, people go and buy music. I think, you know, these trends kind of change rapidly these days. The number two or three music vendor in America is Walmart, you know, for people who go and buy CDs. So, I think when we look at what usage of media is like across the board, it's varied, just like the people are. And there are these emerging trends, right, where there's great streaming services. I'm never going to cancel my Spotify service. I tried out Apple Music. It did too many weird things. I didn't really like it. Mm-hmm. You know, quite frankly, I think the way Spotify works, the user experience, the app is maybe among the worst of any app out there, but it lets me discover things and I can find things that I might not yet want to buy. And there's a whole lot of music that I'm kind of on the fence with, and I use Spotify to listen to that stuff. So, you know, I think, do I worry that people will stop having media? No, right? The people that that we see our users with photography, you know, most of them don't use Google Photos because Google Photos manipulates the photos, or they turn you into the product, right? And now delivering ads by using either, recognition of you know, people or of artifacts in the background and location and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a wide variety of, I think, use cases for why people want to use online services and don't.
Sure.
But the biggest thing that we focused on is less this idea that, you know, what can you do with your photos and what can you do with your music, as much as there is this big change that we saw in computing. And if you go back maybe 10 years ago, computing was a productivity task, right? You would go to the computer typically to go do something like write a document or send an email. It was very task-centric. It was mostly about productivity. And since the smartphone has come out, we've seen this complete transformation in the way people compute. People now compute all day, every day, for every single reason. And you look at the growth rate in the number of devices, internet-enabled devices per person and per household, and it's just skyrocketed in the last 6-7 years, right? It's gone from a couple to, you know, estimates range from 6-7 per person to 11-14 per household. And you know, some people look at these numbers and say, well, you know, the big reason is that, you know, this is the consumerist society, right? People just want to buy stuff, and just more and more stuff is cool, and so you just always buy it. But I don't really think that's the case. What we see clearly is that these devices are context relevant, right? No one walks down the street and says, I want to find a restaurant, I'll get out my laptop, mm-hmm. right? You get out your phone. And if you're going to go and, let's say, edit video, you don't even want to use a laptop. You want a big screen, big hard drive, lots of CPU. These devices are contextually relevant when we're doing different things. That is the difference between the desktop, the laptop, the tablet, and the smartphone. And while we see growth rates in these sort of oscillate, typically it's because, you know, replacement rates are changing. Everyone, you know, sort of predicted, oh, the tablet is dead because no one's buying as many iPads. Well, you don't need to buy an iPad every year, right? Maybe not even every 2 years. The same happened for laptops during the boom years for those device sales, and for desktops as well. So what we see is that people, by and large, you know, in the 70 to 80% penetration rate, have desktops, laptops, tablets, and smartphones, right? They have all of these devices and they use them in different ways. The problem is that over this time, while we all became different types of users, different types of computing users, computers more or less stayed the same, right? I mean, they're fast and they're beautiful and they have loads of features. The problem is that they only care about what's stored on them. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole process that people went through. Well, how do I link these things together, right? And there's USB drives, and then there's online storage. And none of these products or technologies were built to connect computers and unify the content. They were all built around, well, I have something here and here, and how do I sort of, you know, maybe move it from here to here? And the idea around Unity really was that you should never have to think about where something is stored. That location is irrelevant. What we have actually multiple patents on is the ability to sort of change the idea of a file being addressed to a hard drive on a computer or an online service to it being addressed to an identity. So that as you enroll devices into your Unity ecosystem, all these devices now are talking as if they're one. So whatever you do on one becomes available on the other. And it really eliminates this idea of thinking about, well, you know, where is something? Or is that photo, my wife uses Apple Photos on her laptop. I don't like Apple Photos. I use Adobe Lightroom. So, you know, I have kids' photos in both places. And sometimes I need to search and find out, well, how do I find where they are? Not only are these different software products, they're different physical machines. And Unity lets me discover and find all of that all at once with one UI. I don't have to wonder, is it on this machine or that machine? That's irrelevant at this point. So, you know, there may be trends with people streaming music or, you know, putting files in online services. That's great. Ultimately, we don't compete with those because we're not a storage service. In fact, we're now working on integrations with online storage companies so that we can make them what we think is a better product. We can remove the requirement for you to upload everything, or for you to have to, you know, view those files by files and folders, right? You can still look at your media libraries.
Right.
Ultimately, what Unity is aiming at doing is just making it easy for you to go and, like, pick up a device, find whatever it is that you want, and access it right then and there.
You know, so I think that you just hit on something, and I will admit that, you know, our household fits what you just outlined pretty much dead on. I mean, we have multiple computing devices per person, and, you know, we have the issue that, you know, I am from top to bottom all Apple OS. My wife is, she uses the iPhone, but she has Windows machines, and, you know, so we do have a little bit of a disparate ecosystem there, and I even have multiple machines. Now, I had not tried installing the Unity client on more than one desktop. So you're telling me that if I install it on my desktop, I install it on my laptop, then it'll even be seamless between those two. Because even with knowing, I mean, being a technically savvy person and knowing that I have content on both places, sometimes I still have to catch myself and go, oh, where was I working on that project last? And I think that could actually solve a huge problem within our household. A perfect example, just a week ago, 2 weeks ago now, on a family vacation, I took a picture, a selfie with my daughter and I, and unbeknownst to me, my wife took a picture of us taking our selfie, and she showed it to me. I'm like, oh, that's great. You've got to send that to me. Well, it's been 2 weeks, and she still hasn't sent it to me. So it's kind of lost in her little personal world. My stuff's in my personal world. She doesn't have easy access to see my pictures. I don't have easy access to see her pictures. And you know, solving that problem, that is a big deal for me personally. So this will let me do something like that.
That's exactly right. And it doesn't matter if you have a Windows laptop and a Mac desktop, an iPad and an Android phone, right? I mean, that's one of the things Unity does is, you know, one of the biggest thing our Android users love is putting their iTunes catalogs on their Android phones, right? It's, you know, because up to this point, they can't get an iTunes catalog into their Android device's media player.
Right.
They're just incompatible, right? And you look at a lot of these services and products, in some cases, have sort of ecosystem lock-in, right? Apple is obviously all Apple. You know, there's services like iCloud, and, you know, those services work pretty well if, A, you're all Apple, right? And, B, you use Apple software. And, C, you set each one of them up, because let's not ignore the fact there is iCloud for documents, which is totally different than iCloud for music, which is totally different than iCloud for photos.
Right.
Right? And so there's just this vast array of requirements and dependencies and all the things you have to do. You have to marry yourself completely to hardware and software. And then, you know, you always have to follow the rules. Did you upload things? And look, that's what it looks like in the beginning, right? Before all of this matures, and I know it sounds like I'm describing these products and technologies as totally immature, but like this isn't how people use computers, right? No one does this. No one says, like, okay, well, I need to go do this on this device with something else on another device. Whether it's work or personal, you know, people move between devices, and that's natural. That's why we bought them to be different sizes. Mm-hmm. If we needed one device that did everything, people just have like a phone or a tablet or a laptop, but that's not what people have. They have all of them. And it's because they're relevant in these different contexts throughout our day. And a lot of this content is simply incompatible with online storage, right? I mean, if you're into photography, you probably have a DSLR, right? You probably use Adobe Lightroom, almost certainly. These files are big files. It's not like a smartphone photo. These could be 50 plus megabytes in size. Mm-hmm. If you have a GoPro, I don't know if anyone's ever shot GoPro at 1080p or 4K, 1 minute of GoPro is hundreds of megabytes, if not a gigabyte, depending on all the settings that you have, in size, right? So you don't just throw that into your online storage account. A, it'll take forever, right? And B, it just takes up so much space that you better be paying handily for that. So, you know, the problem is that there's just this vast array of considerations we have to make as users for all of these things we do. And ultimately, our goal is not to say, hey, don't use Spotify or, you know, don't use these other things. But go ahead and use them. That's great. It doesn't matter. You're still going to have lots of content. In fact, you're going to have an increasing quantity of content that is going to take up an increasing quantity of storage on a month-by-month basis. Every year, you're going to get the new iPhone. It's going to have a better camera.
Right.
It's going to have a bigger. The photos are going to be larger format. You're going to go get a GoPro 5. I'm sure the files are going to be even bigger than the 4 and the 3. So, you know, all of these things evolve and change, and they create complexity. So ultimately, our goal is to reduce the complexity, to say, I've got a file somewhere. Right now I can grab my phone. I've got every photo I've ever taken in my life, the same with all the photos my wife has ever taken. I can find these very easily using search. You know, I have all of the music I've ever collected. Some of it's in iTunes, some of it is not. Some of it is not organized content. But what Unity does as part of just how the technology works is it mines out all the metadata from the content so it can organize it for you. So if you add all your music to the library in iTunes, it then has artist and genre and things like that. Unity does that even if you don't add it to the library. If we'll discover all the iTunes catalog curation you have, but then all the stuff from college days on a hard drive that's sort of connected to the computer, where you just have a bunch of old junk, we now crawl all of that and say, well, here's all of it organized by artist or genre or things like that. So it's really about taking everything and making it easily searchable, browsable, and accessible.
So, you know, it, like I said, I installed it and had, you know, zero problems. I'm a technical person, but, you know, I feel comfortable, like I said, you know, giving it to reasonably non-technical people and they would be able to figure it out. So I think you guys have done a great job with that. You know, how do you address security concerns? And I realize no data is being stored on, you know, servers that you guys have. It's all coming from my computer. I know that one of the popular buzzwords now, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, is, you know, zero knowledge cloud services. You know, how does you know, what Entangled Media is doing and what Unity is doing fit in with that? How does it, you know, how do I know that that content that I'm accessing from my laptop on my desktop, that that's secure, that, you know, just like Dropbox, it's just been announced, I think this last week, that the hack from 2012 was even bigger than they originally thought. Almost 70 million accounts were compromised. You know, what do you do to ensure that people's data is safe in transit? And, you know, and then how do you educate people who may not be incredibly savvy on how to basically, how do you tell them, hey, this is safe and here's why it's safe, and make a layperson understand why that's important?
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, the term zero knowledge cloud was probably popularized to the extent it's popularized by Edward Snowden when he sort of talked about, right, you know, the difference between public clouds. An example of public cloud would be like Facebook is a public cloud, Dropbox is a public cloud. It's these cloud services to where there's lots and lots of content and everyone's content is stored together, right? On Dropbox, my stuff is stored with your stuff and everyone else's stuff, right, across this wide range of storage servers they have. So it's very public, right? A zero knowledge cloud can be a public cloud. Typically, though, what it is a cloud service that has no knowledge of the content. Generally speaking, these are not public clouds, right? Most things can be decrypted, so sometimes people are like, well, we encrypt it before we put it there. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. Client-side encryption of content before it goes into online storage is a good thing. Unity is probably the extreme form of zero-knowledge cloud, and that is nothing is stored, right? So forget getting hacked. Okay, let's just say hackers or government or somebody kicks down the door in the data center where all of our servers are, and they take the servers.
Right.
There's nothing on them, right? So we don't know about what people have or what people do. When streams are in transit, let's say you're on your phone and you're streaming a video or music from your computer, those are encrypted streams. We generally try and either do direct connections if you're on the same network between the devices. If you're on a remote network, let's say you're at work and your computer is at home, we'll attempt P2P connections, and those will be encrypted. Mm-hmm. Some cases, people's networks don't allow peer-to-peer. This can happen, especially in corporate environments.
Right.
So we'll use what's called an HTTP relay server. This is a dumb box that we host, and it basically brokers connections between the two devices, and it's encrypted on each end there, so that it goes through the relay server and it's encrypted. So really, no matter how you look at this, we don't have any information about any of the content. We don't know what people are doing, what they have. You know, if someone is streaming something, we don't know who it is, and we don't know what is getting streamed. So, you know, our zero knowledge cloud is really one where there's just an absolute absence of any knowledge of what people are doing. So in that sense, Unity is incredibly secure. It's a very robust security model. You know, that's not by accident. You know, my background for a while was in information security, as was Mike Abraham, my co-founder. Mm-hmm. You know, so one of the things we said in the very beginning was, we just don't want people's data, right? It's going to get hacked, in my experience, and you're going to have to deal with it. So if you don't have it, it's maybe a more efficient system, and it's certainly a more secure system. So we did that by design. We just didn't want to have the information. And it is technically very challenging to build a product like Unity in that way. So, you know, probably by most standards from, you know, talking as an entrepreneur who's trying to build a company, it's not a very good decision because it really backs you into a corner. That said, it's incredibly efficient. One of the benefits that we can pass on to our users is Unity is really, really affordable because we don't have to store all of your stuff. So, you know, I think when we look at cloud technology, it's a catch-22. We need these technologies for the convenience sake of what we want. But you can pretty much rest assured that they're always going to get hacked. I mean, it's something that is certain. Some people, because of this, only put a few things that they want in online services. You know, we regularly get parents saying, I don't want the photos of my children ever to be able to get out, right? I don't want to put them in Google Photos or Dropbox or Facebook or anywhere because whether it's a hack or the privacy settings will change or something, this information will get out, and I just don't want it. Kids' photos are a really big deal. We get, when it comes to videos and photos, that's one of the big things that our users talk to us a lot about. And we can very comfortably say that, look, that's not a problem with us. We don't have them. We don't even know what the photos are. And the only way someone's really going to get them using Unity is if you give out your username and password, which we absolutely don't recommend you do, right? Because as soon as you do that, everyone has all of your stuff. So
right.
I wouldn't call that like a security vulnerability as much as, you know, common sense. Don't give out the username and password.
Well, you know, so following on that, you know, talking about how these services, it seems inevitable that data breaches happen, and, you know, by not storing it, you're certainly alleviating that angle of it. You know, what are some of the steps that you take to protect users from themselves? Obviously, if my password is password or 123456, you know, how, you know, what can you guys do to try and make it so that, you know, my credentials aren't compromised? You know, I know that a lot of sites are embracing multi-factor authentication, although I don't know that I feel comfortable giving, you know, a token-based system to the average user, you know. So what are some of the things that you do to ensure that, you know, I'm not going to get compromised because I've just made a bad decision in picking a bad password using a platform like this?
Right. So we, of course, employ, you know, a variety of best practices, right? So, you know, there's password complexity requirements mm-hmm. to make sure it's not, you know, 12345 or something like that. And we have a variety of sort of security notices that we provide to people. So every time you register a device using Unity, so let's say you go and you buy the iPhone 7, right?
Right.
As soon as you register that device with your Unity account, we'll send an email to you to make sure that we tell you, you know, this, you know, Jacob's iPhone 7 was just registered to your account. If this was not you, contact us immediately. So, you know, I would say that we look at what are the best practices to make sure that it is either difficult for you to, you know, pick a weak password and or notify you if something does go wrong. We also make it to where you can unregister any device from any device, right? So
okay.
You can either say, look, my phone got stolen. I've got Unity on it. How do I take Unity off of it? No sweat. From any device you have, you can unregister any device. So if I get rid of my computer or my phone is stolen or something like that, I can just grab another device, go into Unity settings, and immediately disconnect it, and it wipes out all the data and doesn't allow it to access anything. So, you know, we've in the past had things like pin locking. We kind of got rid of that. Some people wanted it, other than people complained about it just doesn't work too well, and Apple kind of makes it a little bit of a challenge.
Right.
So we always look at the things that will help sort of provide a baseline level of best practices. And we try and stay up with those.
Now, for the demographic that you're targeting, is educating them about security and the benefits of keeping all of your data something that you have to do, or is it something that, you know, are you primarily seeing wider adoption with technically savvy people? You know, how do you educate people as you try and scale and grow? Because, you know, there's only so many technical people that understand how technology or security works that, you know, you can sign into your platform before you've got to start, you know, reaching out and getting, you know, maybe less sophisticated people? And is that a concern? Do people say, you know, how, prove to me that this is secure, and how do you make that, how do you make that, how do you educate them on that, I suppose?
Generally, the answer is no. And we're for better or worse, a little bit backwards in this sort of user acquisition model. Our user base is primarily non-tech savvy folks. So, you know, it's really common for a product to launch and, you know, the technorati are really sort of the key demographic in the early days. And you're getting people that really get it. But by and large, when we've done user surveys and we talk to our users, it's shockingly, it's your average person, right? I mean, we've done surveys to where, you know, one of the folks is like, I couldn't live without this product. I'm like, well, what do? I'm a farmer. What? I'm a farmer. When I drive on my tractor around my farm, I use Unity to stream all the stuff that I have back in, on my home computer. I was watching a movie while the tractor's driving around, or listening to music, and which just blew me away, right? We've had school teachers, a lot of school teachers actually, that use Unity to access content when they're out and about. We've had schools contact us for them to distribute lesson plans using it. So, you know, what we found is, and this is not necessarily convenient, because we found that we have a very wide demographic. It represents a very diverse group of people that don't tend to be, you know, the really tech savvy folks that, you know, are reading TechCrunch or other, you know, tech blogs.
Right.
It's much more broad based. It's very, very international. You know, I would say I have found that the skepticism on security is much higher in the EU than it is in the US. Generally speaking, you've always got these people that, you know, are, you know, like, these guys are, you know, part of the NSA and they just want your stuff. I mean, what can you do, right? I mean, it's there are folks with conspiracy theories, so, you know, you just kind of, you know, don't feed the trolls. So, you know, it is one of those things to where, I think in general it's not a big concern. People sort of look at, like, free or cheap, and they're like, well, clearly they're not storing my stuff. You know, we blog about it a lot and talk about, you know, the security aspects of this. But more or less, I think our users really kind of gravitate towards the fact that they're not putting my stuff anywhere. I'm streaming it right from my computer. And that in and of itself has some limitations. So we get a lot of feedback to, you know, hey, how can you remove those limitations? But, you know, at the same time, it seems like people can quickly glean what Unity does that's different. Users all the time are like, oh, I don't need to use Dropbox anymore. To me, I'm like, I don't know how that's the case. Like, I couldn't stop. I use Unity all the time, but I couldn't stop using Dropbox and services like them.
Right.
So, you know, it's like I said before, I really think that this is enough of an emerging technology to where people, there aren't other companies really doing this, that sort of how the market perceives it and how we start getting users and what those users are like is still in the early days. And, you know, we do as much as we can to sort of figure out, how do we go get the right people? And to us, the right people are not necessarily tech savvy or security conscious as much as people that have lots of content that want to access it. And it turns out there's a whole lot of those people.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the farmers. You know, Jeff and I, being from the Midwest, we tend to be quite an agrarian state. And my brother-in-law's father is a farmer, and they're surprisingly sophisticated because, you know, if you are at all successful, you tend to have a lot of disposable income, surprisingly. And, I mean, he upgrades his computer more often than almost anyone I know who is not in a technical field. It always, you know, just cracks me up when he's, you know, running the absolute latest and greatest. And, you know, they run, I think it's like a $30,000 a year software package that just monitors, you know, all of the GPS feed and data that is on their equipment and, you know, samples the soil. So it's amazing. Farmers are way more technically sophisticated than I think people give them credit for. It's kind of impressive. You know, one thing I noticed that is pretty predominant on the Unity website is, you know, talking about, you know, building your own home media server, you know, building your own streaming service. And, you know, certainly, you know, music is something that I think people pretty much have a lot of, and we don't think too much about it. And, you know, because of, you know, Amazon and Apple getting access to digital music files, especially DRM-free files, or, you know, sort of the way it is, you know, how do you position the company and the app to provide those, you know, sort of media, home media server services without getting folded into that whole, well, you promote piracy, you know, because, you know, not everybody's going to be like Jeff, who has thousands of DVDs that they need to rip and be able to stream. And I know Plex does that and seems to fly under the radar. People don't tend to think of Plex as a piracy app, but, you know, is that something that you're concerned about? How do you avoid any connotations with that? You know, is that something that's even on the radar?
I mean, it's not on our radar because we have no real relationship with piracy. I mean, it's not like a BitTorrent product where I can go and get stuff that other people have, right? So, you know, in that sense, you can't pirate a movie or a song or anything like that with Unity. You know, we just give you access to the things that you have, and, you know, we really don't show any prejudice to what it is that you have, right? Mm-hmm. So we're sort of unaware of that, you know, again, in the sense, like, we don't even know what are on people's computers. Now, if there is a DRM file, we can't stream it, right? We don't know how to, you know, well, we don't want to break DRM on anything. So we don't solve that problem if it's DRM. You know, how people have non-DRM, you know, movies or things like that is, you know, certainly at their discretion.
Sure.
You know, we instead focus on making sure you can always have access to it. And we have to do that in very sort of, you know, interesting technical ways. You think about on an iPhone, you know, and I'm always in my management job these days, a couple steps behind these changes. But I think the iPhone, or iOS rather, supports four types of audio and two types of video, right? And if you have anything other than four types of audio and those two types of video, it doesn't play on an iPhone or an iPad. Android likewise has similar requirements for, they only play certain codecs or formats of audio and video. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that Unity does, and we'll be enhancing this in the coming months, but we, you know, we do this now, is we will optimize the content you have for the device. So a lot of our users came to us and said, hey, I've got FLAC files. You know, can you play my FLAC files, which are lossless audio or, you know, other similar types of music formats on my iPhone? And yes, the answer is we do, right? So if you have lossless audio or, you know, MKV type of video or other types of formats that are non-standard that an iPhone or an Android device won't play, we'll convert those on the fly in real time and stream them in the proper format. And we also optimize the audio quality, for example, to say, if this is a lossless file, don't transcode it and reduce its music quality any more than is necessary. And we can do that by saying, hey, if you're on the same network, don't change the audio quality at all. Just make it format compatible with my phone or with my Apple TV, right, which has similar requirements. If I'm on a remote network, maybe you don't want a 1440 kilobit per second type of stream because it's going to buffer and skip and things like that. So maintain an optimal high quality stream in addition to format. So, you know, a lot of things that we focus on instead are optimizing the content, you know, and making sure that not only can you get it, but it's the right quality and that it's compatible.
Is that something that, you know, power users have the ability to go in and fiddle with, or is it just done intelligently in the app and it's sort of hidden from the user?
Well, right now it's intelligently in the app and it's hidden from the user. For music, I don't know that we'll open up those options because we generally just try and say, look, you got to get the best quality music. Don't mess with it.
Sure. Right?
With video, we'll be releasing an updated feature in the next month to 2 months to where we'll let you adjust video quality so that, you know, if it's going, obviously video quality can be lower but maintain an HD experience on a phone than it needs to from a bitrate standpoint going to a giant TV.
Right.
Right. So, you know, do I need a 2 gig to 5 gig video file if I'm streaming it to my phone? No, I don't. We can optimize that for the size of the iPhone screen or an Android screen. Whereas we might want the whole whack when it comes to streaming it to a 65-inch, you know, Ultra HD TV. So, you know, we're looking at enhancing that so that it's much more adjustable per the user's sort of choice.
Okay, I gotcha. You know, I know that the app is available on iOS and Android. Do you have any relationships with, you know, like Roku or any of the companies that make the set-top boxes for channels or plugins so that you can get this content more easily in the living room? And that may be a redundant question. I know that, you know, a lot of people are moving away from, you know, viewing on a big screen, but, you know, I'm I'm 40 and I still like sitting down in front of the television to watch a movie, as opposed to, you know, my 6-year-old daughter who's completely content to watch YouTube videos all day long on a little 4-inch iPhone screen.
Yeah, so right now we're compatible with AirPlay on iOS, and we're releasing in Android in the next month a Chromecast integration. So we'll have Chromecast and Apple TV covered. That's a good part of the market. We're looking at other integrations, for example, with Roku or with Fire TV. We sort of look at what those devices are doing in market. Are they grabbing market share or losing it? And then sort of go through, which ones do we prioritize to integrate with. So we integrate with some of those now, and we're adding them on a regular basis, whether it's, every couple of months or, every quarter, we're adding new devices.
Okay. Jeff, do you want to jump in and talk about how they, how to scale, monetize, sort of the business end of Unity?
Well,
or
I mean,
Unify?
You know.
Or Unity. I've got too many acronyms running through my head today. I apologize.
Unity. No, I mean, obviously you guys have gone to you have a model where it's a monthly fee for the premium version, right?
Yes.
Now, so right now the only way you can buy that is through the app. How is that working out for you? I mean, I assume you have to revenue share that with Google and with Apple, right?
Sadly.
I mean, can you talk about, is there plans to get away from that, or are you just bite the bullet and saying, yeah, that's the way it's going to be, or,
No, I mean, it's a tricky consideration when you're an app developer. Look, obviously, giving away almost a third of your revenue, it sucks.
Yeah, right? That hurts.
It is. It's a total drag, right? I mean, you appreciate the platform, but they're, should they be taking a third of the revenue? I wish they weren't. And some of these are changing. Google is making some really great changes with the Play Store and reducing the rev share. Apple sort of ceremonially doing that. If you have a user who's been around for a year, on the 13 month forward, they'll reduce their rev share.
Okay.
Hopefully they follow Google, right? That would be great if Apple said, wow, Google did this, so why don't we just change it as well? When you're a developer, we originally wanted to do it outside of the App Store initially, and it's just quite frankly very, very hard to get away from their requirements.
Right.
The requirements are extremely broad, and they're also very vague, right? And those two things make trying to thread the needle, very challenging. From our point of view, we had to go with the app stores first. Mm-hmm. We will be offering a different type of subscription online in the next month. So our users will be able to, if they choose, they can cancel their monthly and they can go to annual or they can go to lifetime. We'll make the annual obviously a better deal than paying monthly, and we'll make the lifetime a really fantastic deal. So, our goal is to sort of find, how do users want to pay for this and what is convenient for them, and optimize our revenue model around what's working in the best possible way.
And I'm assuming that you'll keep the a non-paid tier for people to get in and see what it is and get their feet wet. What are you doing to differentiate the the free version from the paid version? What is there to entice someone to, hey, I'll pay a couple of bucks a month for this because I'm getting value or a feature that I'm not getting on the the introductory free tier.
Right. Yeah. So the way that we've created the premium version right now is around features that are primary to power users.
Okay.
Right? So we wanted to have a paywall that everyone didn't necessarily hit, that you could use the app casually and not have to pay. The first three things that we included, one is remote access, so streaming to a device from different networks. And that largely is because we actually incur costs for that, right? It does cost us something to develop and maintain all these servers. And the P2P framework that we built is highly customized. And, it's pretty expensive for us to maintain so that our users don't have to do what they have to do with Plex, right? Plex requires you to open ports on your firewall and do all these complicated things that most people neither want to do nor know how to do.
Right.
So we go to great lengths to make it to where it could be the way you describe, which is you can go give it to your parents. So like I took me 30 seconds to install this thing and it works and I never have to think about it again. So, you know, remote access is something we incur a lot of costs for. So that's part of the premium subscription. But then, you know, increasing the quality through our intelligent transcoding, figuring out what network are you on? How do we optimize the type of music for you? Maybe we can transcode it for format, but leave the quality, you know, the way it is. Or based on your bandwidth, maybe we'll adjust that. So these sort of things that make Unity a bit more intelligent is sort of how we've differentiated. We look at what percentage of people really engage with those features and what is their feedback on why they use them. And what we discovered was is that, you know, this gives, you know, 30 to 50% of our users that are the power users, you know, the ability to get a lot of value out of Unity Premium, but most of the others more casual usage. But I will say that what we find is that we're regularly debating, like, do we make something free or do we charge for it? And sort of, you know, where do we draw the line? And it becomes quite difficult to sort of figure out where you divide the line or draw the line, right? Is it,
right.
Do we do it because it just makes the product awesome and more people should pay for it? Or do we only do it because it incurs money? Or cost to us, rather. And that becomes sort of a challenging conversation. And in some cases, you know, you think of your paywall as somewhat contrived, right? It's, look, we're a company. We need people to pay, right? So sure. We can't stay in business if we don't build something that people are willing to pay for. We'll just run out of cash eventually and the investors will say, forget it. So, you know, we'll have to shut down. So it's important that we figure out what that is. But it's sometimes frustrating when you're like, okay, well, let's just make something a paywall feature so that we have a paywall. So I would say internally we talk a lot about, well, you know, do we move towards better pricing or maybe more optimal pricing and no free version, but you get a longer trial. You know, those are debates that we have. Our paywall is relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that we're doing a lot of testing around and you know, we're talking about strategizing about continuously.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I think it's the early days to say how it's going to work. In some regards, some of us like the idea of, look, you get a good trial of the product to see if you like it. And then we optimize price, but you have to pay.
Right.
And it's really just about us. How do we keep making it better? Right. Not how do we make it better for some people, but not for others? Because that kind of doesn't feel genuine, you know, to say it's like, let's work on some cool stuff, but then only give it to the paying people. You know, you always get people that are unhappy, like, well, why can't you make that free? Like, I think it should be free, right? So it's like, well, you know, look, I don't know what to tell you. Like, we have things, you know, we have to make the paid version better. So, you know, time will tell as to whether there will always be a free version. I think, you know, we look at pricing it aggressively. We want it to be both the best product in market and the most affordable price in market. If we can make a really, really good product and have a price point be low, people should pay for it, right? And we're already seeing, actually, with our pricing, shockingly high conversions. I mean, we didn't think the paid conversions would be as high as they are. Granted, it's the very, very early days. You know, we're talking days of data here.
Right.
But, you know, it's very good positive reinforcement for us.
Well, and like you said, it is aggressively priced. I mean, it's what, $2.99 a month for the premium features, and that's not a lot of money. I mean,
not really.
You know, well, that's a Starbucks. That's a one Starbucks coffee.
Yeah. For a month. That's not much.
Yeah, and not even a fancy Starbucks coffee.
We do a good job of sort of, you know, reinforcing this idea is that, you know, for power users, Unity is, you know, a way to access stuff all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for the casual user, it's an insurance policy, right? I mean, the things actually my wife uses it for infrequently are the things I think that would get her to pay for it more effectively, right? To her, it is, she's at work and she needs to print a photo of one of our girls, and she can quickly grab any photo out of her Apple Photos library and print it at the nearest printer,
right,
using AirPrint. Right? Or we're in the car going somewhere and she forgot to email something to her boss, grabs it on the phone and quickly can email it. You know, we've now got users we're seeing post, you know, their fine art photography into Instagram using Unity on a regular basis, right? It's these things that are not even necessarily like, I need to access my stuff all the time, but I need to do something with something intermittently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, seeing incredibly compelling usage of the product over a really long period of time because of those things. So you know, it becomes pretty hard to say, like, okay, well, like, what do we make? Do we charge for certain things just because it looks like it's a good opportunity? Or do we just make it really easy on ourselves and say, look, we need to make a great product. It needs to get better each and every single month. And then when we need to price it affordably and make it to where people want to pay that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm of the opinion, I'd much rather know I'm going to pay X every month, and maybe I use it a bunch this month, and maybe I don't use it very much or even at all the next month. But I like that model better than, oh, hey, you need to grab this file, that's going to be a nickel. You need to do this, that's going to be a dollar. I don't like the microtransaction model myself, but I understand. I mean, you know, businesses and innovators need to eat too, so it not everything can be free on the internet. I think we all like to think it should be, but...
It's tough. People like free stuff. We all do. I like right. free stuff. You know, it's one of those things to where, you know, it's when you've been free for a while, you know, that transition to paid certainly stirs up the ire of some people, you know. How dare you ask for my money for this product that you've made?
Yeah.
You know, so it's a hard transition sometimes. I'd say fortunately for us, it wasn't too bad, right? It we didn't get too much ire. We got you know, in fact, a lot of times when we do surveys, people are like, I don't understand why you guys don't charge for it. I'd pay for it. And it's like, okay, that's great to hear. So we're going to charge you for it. And we'll sort of see how that goes.
Yeah, but you put your money where your mouth is.
right.
Well, Eric, I know we've been talking for about an hour, and that's the time we had slotted for you. So, how do people find Unity? How do they, you know, learn more about the company? You know, what are the ways they can follow you guys, learn about you, download it, give it a try? You know, how do they get a hold of yourself? Promote yourself and the product and the company.
Sure. So it's easy. Everything is at getunity.com. Unity is spelled this cool, fancy, modern way of Y-O-U-N-I-T-Y. You just go to getunity.com. You can download the software. You can learn all about us and sort of what the features of the product are, how we started the company. We got a blog that talks about all kinds of cool things, whether it's security or, you know, new product features or things that are happening in the market. And we're on social media with Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Excellent. And we'll provide links in the show note to the website and to your Facebook and Twitter and all of that fun stuff so that people can hopefully you know, easily click through and, you know, follow you and keep up and all of that good stuff.
Great.
Okay, so that is Eric Cazzo at Entangled Media. So check out the Unity app at getunity.com. We appreciate Eric coming on the show. And so check it out and let us know if you guys, you know, play with it, what you think of it. I will say one thing, and we had talked about this in the interview, and I finally had a chance to install the client on my laptop. I've had it on my desktop for a while. And the one thing I couldn't figure out how to do, and I don't know if it's just me being an idiot, which I will just absolutely admit could be the case, or if the app maybe doesn't do it yet, but I was hoping that there was a way to sync my media between my desktop and my laptop. I can get it all on my mobile device, but I can't see my laptop files from my desktop and vice versa. So I gotta follow up with the Unity people and find out if you can do that. But otherwise, works absolutely great for getting stuff off of your desktop or your laptop at home on your mobile device. So check it out. Jeff, I understand you have some breaking news.
Well, yeah, you know, we were talking about the Samsung recall, so I thought I'd throw in the two cents of, I know we've talked before about the Volkswagen TDI, Passat TDI, mm-hmm. that we have, and all the rigmarole that surrounded that. We got an update this past week, got a letter from Volkswagen. It basically stated that it's not officially finalized yet. They have put in their... this is what we want to do to the judge. The judge is supposed to rule on it in October. But based on the current, you know, what they're proposing for the settlement, you go right. online, you put your VIN in, and it tells you everything. There, you have two options, basically. The first option is you can keep your vehicle. They will fix it. And by fix, I mean your mileage, your miles per gallon is going to go way down.
But do they have a fix, like a technical fix for it yet?
They haven't announced what the technical fix is. I think it's basically just quit cheating and don't emit so much pollution. And I think that's just a software fix, to be honest with you, mm-hmm. For my car. I know that the smaller cars, they're, there is a system in my car that uses BlueDEF, which is a additive. And so I think on the bigger cars like mine, it's really just a matter of a computer fix, but it's probably going to lower your gas mileage by, they haven't said for sure, but by 25%.
That's a big bite.
Yeah, it is. If you do that, and they'll fix it, they'll give you back your car, and they'll give you $7,100. Okay. And that $7,100 is to offset the, you know, increased cost of fuel efficiency and then the shame on us fee. So that's option one. Option two is you turn your car back into them, you walk away. If you do that, in the case of us, so it's they pay you what your car was worth before the announcement based on Blue Book value. So for us, if we trade our car in, we get the car paid off, so we just walk away, plus an additional $6,000. Plus
decisions.
Wait, plus the 7,100.
Oh, you still get the 7,100.
Yes. So if I trade it in, I'm going to get a little over 13,000. If we keep it, we'll get 7,100.
Man, 13,000 is a mighty big down payment on something else.
It is.
And if you don't take it in and have the fix done, will it have any resale whatsoever down the road?
No, and if you don't take it in and get the fix done, you don't get the 7,100.
Oh, so you can't just say, thanks, but no thanks, I'll keep it as is and give me my 7,100.
Nope.
Oh.
No,
so you're going to kill your economy, your fuel economy, either way.
Right. Right. Mm. So we're going to be trading that in.
Trade it in.
Yeah. It's $6,000. I mean, it's just like,
yeah.
Yep.
Why would I not do that? So anyway.
So you're a car guy. What have you got your eye on? Like, what, you know, replaces that? Because you bought it for mileage, right?
Wasn't it
like stickered at 50 miles per
gallon? No, it's stickered at 40. Okay. We get 50.
Ah.
Pretty regularly. But we're kind of looking at a Honda Accord hybrid.
Oh, okay.
At least for now. That's kind of what I'm looking at.
Very
we'll see.
Cool. Nice. And I mean, like 13 grand, that's like what, a third down?
Yeah.
Something like that? 30%, 35%?
Well, you were just talking about having to buy a new car for the son. Yeah.
Right.
That's going to help a lot.
Might be that $13,000 that you're getting there. But you still have to buy a car for your wife.
Yeah, absolutely.
So either way, two cars.
Yeah.
Yay.
But so that's the update. Now, I know it's not the same for everybody because, again, I think the $7,100 is the same for every Passat owner. I think that the diesels that are, you know, less expensive cars, you know, the Passat's kind of their flagship sedan. So I know the lesser ones are less money, but for everyone that owned a Passat diesel, it's the $7,100 is the same. The additional that we're getting is based on what our specific car would have been worth before Dieselgate hit. So that will vary depending on what kind of car you had and what options and yada, yada, yada. So,
yeah. And you got it pretty loaded. So that's probably why you're getting so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. So that's the update.
I'm curious if we'll start hearing more in the media about it. Cause that story has kind of died out. I haven't heard much about it in a few months.
Information on the internet said that we could probably expect to trade it in around November 1st.
That's pretty quick.
So we'll see. I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on. I mean, to me, this is a worst case scenario because the judge isn't going to go, no, you're doing too much, Volkswagen. don't do so much. I mean, the worst that's going to happen is the judge is going to go, no, you have to give $8,000 or, you know, whatever.
Right.
So, you know, we'll see what if the judge approves it in October. I assume that if he does approve it in October, that November 1st will probably be the date that they're shooting for. So
interesting. That's very cool.
I don't see how they're staying in business. I mean, this has got to kill them bad.
I mean, they were saying what, like 15 or 20 billion was going to be the liability hit just in North America. And they have this problem in Europe too.
Yeah.
And I think all over
just
the world.
Ugly. Just so ugly.
Man.
Supposedly
that's why you don't cheat, guys.
Yeah, exactly. Supposedly they're going to have some like big offers where like, if you go back in and trade your car and say, yeah, I don't want it. Like they'll give you an extra $4,000 if you buy, you know, a normal Volkswagen or, you know, whatever, but
just to move units,
just to get people in Volkswagens again, you know,
I gotcha.
but I don't think we're going to do that.
I don't know. I mean, I had a gas Volkswagen years ago, and it was a great car.
Ian loves the car. It's just like, I feel like, you know, kind of shame on them, so I don't want to buy another one. It's kind of how I feel.
Or does it make Volkswagen the best company to buy from right now because they are absolutely going to be like walking the straight and narrow and not pulling any shenanigans?
Yeah, I guess that's
and there's two ways to look at it.
But
if it depends on if you're a pessimist or an optimist.
That's right. You know me, Mr. Optimism. Anywho.
Glass is kind of half full.
The glass is full.
It's always full. It's half full of water and half full of air.
So which one do you two want to tell me what they love first? Because I get to go last.
Go ahead, Todd.
I love MLB.com at bat. It's a great app. We're heading into the baseball playoff season, and you know, I've been a long-suffering Cubs fan, but they're the best team in the majors right now. Record,
imagine that.
And you know, I think it's important to remember that anybody can have a bad century, and so this is a this is a new year coming up, and if you want to follow your favorite team, MLB.com at bat, it's great for your mobile device. You can cast your screen. It's got a lot of video highlights, box scores, condensed games when the game is over, if you want to watch the whole thing in like 15 minutes. It's about, I think it's $20 a year, so it is a little bit of money, but it's something that I really enjoy, and I look at it just about every day during the baseball season, which is 6 months long, plus playoffs.
Well, and can you watch all of your team's games?
No. That's for $150 a
year. I was going to say, $20 a year, if you got 162 games out of it, that's a pretty good deal.
You do get the audio feeds, but you don't get the video.
So being a T-Mobile customer, I got the video subscription for free. Oh,
yes, T-Mobile gives it to you for free. Good point.
Yeah, and I have watched, I've probably watched 24 games this year, which Todd can probably attest to the fact that that's 2,000% higher than what I've ever watched ever before.
So just because that's more than I've watched.
Yeah, but it's the video is amazing. Like, it is good. It really is.
I love going to a ballpark and watching baseball, but to watch it on TV or remotely or listen to it on the radio, I couldn't possibly care less.
Well, MLB at Bat had brought me back in. I mean, it is really a good app. It is top notch. So good, I think that HBO paid them to do their app.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The HBO Go app now is based on the MLB at Bat technology.
That's very cool. Huh.
So
neat.
That's what I love.
Awesome. So what I love is a show that has just started its third season. I think we're two, three episodes into it. I think three. It'll be four this week. It is the AMC series Halt and Catch Fire. I don't know if either of you guys watch that or if you've even heard of it.
I've heard of it. Have not watched it.
You've heard of it?
Have not seen it.
People don't know about it. I think it's a sleeper. So the third season just started. You can watch seasons one and two on Netflix, and I highly recommend not jumping in because you will not know what the heck is going on. It is set in the early 80s in season one, I think 82 maybe, and now I think they're in about 1986. The first season is sort of the revolution of the home clone desktop from the IBM PC. And then season two sort of expands on that into early online communities. And now season three is fully into this online company competing with like CompuServe and Prodigy and those types of services. The show's creator does an amazing job of getting the tech to feel, you know, spot on. I've read that they do a lot to make sure they're using period accurate props and screens, and you can definitely tell. I mean, the show really feels like it's set in the 80s, and you know, kind of, I know we've talked a few weeks ago about Stranger Things and that sort of 80s nostalgia vibe, and this show really hits on it well. The story is pretty compelling. There are a few things that they do with technology that were not possible at the time. I'm sure it's just to move things along and create dramatic suspension. You know, there were a few times, especially in season two, where I was kind of saying, what the what? You can't do that. But, you know, I'm a hardcore nerd and I'm willing to forgive it because, you know, my wife, who is somewhat technical but not nearly as bad as me, was like, why does that bother you so much? So if you're just a lay tech person, or, you know, you can get past it. You can get past it. It's really good. What I think is interesting is they are not actually copying any of the companies of the PC and tech revolution. They are all fictitious companies, but they cut very close to the actual history of that time. So it is a really good show. I highly recommend you check it out. If you have Comcast or really probably any on demand, I think you can get caught up on this year that just started season 3. It's got some really good actors in it. Lee Pace, Scoot McNairy, Carrie Bechet, and Mackenzie Davis are the four main cast members. So check it out if you haven't. Halt and Catch Fire. Like I said, you can see seasons 1 and 2 on Netflix, and season 3 just started and can get caught up on demand. I highly recommend it if you are into sort of that 80s nostalgia era of the PC. It's a great show. I highly recommend it. That is what I love. Jeff, what about you?
I'm going to throw in a music pick. Found a new band thanks to a online friend, and the band is called Blitzen Trapper. They are, I guess what I would call them at this point is alt country, maybe. They have,
yeah, I could see that.
They have some folk, rock, indie, I don't know.
A little Americana.
A little Americana maybe in there. My favorite album so far has been Black River Killer, which came out in 2009. I also like Fur, which came in 2008. But I haven't found any songs that I just hate. It's very, like I said, folksy Americana. I really enjoy it. It's not what I would call upbeat. So keep that in mind. If you're like looking for a pick me up, this probably isn't the music for you. But I really enjoy it, and cannot recommend them enough. So check them out, Blitzen Trapper.
Now, I know you had sent me an album to check out, and I listened to it. I've actually listened to it a few times because I can't quite decide if I like it or not. And it's not the two that you just mentioned.
No,
which album did you send me?
I sent you American Goldwing. It's more current.
American Goldwing.
Go check those two that I just mentioned out. Those are kind of my favorites at this point. And then they also have a couple on Apple Music, a couple of live albums that are very recent, and those are also excellent. So
cool.
You know, go on that Apple Music or Spotify, and I, like I said, Fur and Black River Killer are my favorites so far.
And I just wanted to ask, if I am not crazy, but does the lead singer sound like a young Bob Dylan?
You know, I hear Bob Dylan sometimes. I hear Petty sometimes.
Okay, I could see Petty, sure.
Maybe even some Neil Young. Like, throw those three in a blender, and that's kind of what you got. But yeah, I can see, definitely.
Very cool.
So yeah, that's what I love.
Awesome.
So you have just listened to another fine episode of the No Better Than Average podcast. We want to remind you about our call-in comment line, which is 317-643-1212. Ask a question, rant, listen. We'll listen to what you have to say, and we'll put you on the air and make you internet famous. Please give us any feedback that you would like to at feedback@nobettershow.com. Give us a few kind words on iTunes. Rate us, review us, subscribe. Those go a long way to getting our name out there and helping us out. So until next time, thank you so much for listening. Now, hopefully you know better than average too. Thanks, everybody.
Have a great week, everyone.
Talk at you later, everyone.